Well, good evening. Glad you all made it out. We'll have a question and answer session at the end. So, be prepared to ask questions. Let me tell you just a little bit about myself. I grew up going to church. It was a traditional Protestant denomination. And, you know, I was the guy who carried the cross and wore those funny vestments. And I was the president of the church youth group. But the problem is, I didn't believe in God. Now, apparently, in that group, it didn't really matter. But so I went off to college, and I was an atheist. In fact, I was kind of proud to be an atheist. I can remember the Christian guy sharing. Maybe some of you know who Josh McDowell is. He's this big guy on Christian evidence back in the day. He was there at the University of Connecticut, and my Christian friend was sharing. We were like, whatever, you know. And I remember taking a philosophy as a freshman. And there we studied Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is famous for saying, God is dead. I was like, yes, that's so good. But now I think, well, Nietzsche's dead and God seems to be doing just okay. So what I'm going to do tonight, actually my presentation will be in two parts. The first part will be essentially why I believe from a scientific perspective, you have to believe there's a God. By the way, you can't prove the existence of God. There's no mathematical formula, blah, 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 square root, integral, blah, blah, equals God. But I think what you can show is the most reasonable assumption by far, conclusion, is that God exists. Then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about science and its relationship to Christianity itself. So we're going to consider two options, two ways of thinking about it. One would be represented by Thomas Huxley, who was a good friend of Charles Darwin. He was called Darwin's bulldog. And what he said was, we are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth through the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. So this is the atheist perspective, which essentially says it's all just random. It's just an accident. There's no purpose, no meaning. A more recent commentator of the same sort, perhaps more famous today, is Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion. He said, in the universe of blind forces, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, it just is, and we dance to its music. Now, if this was true, it certainly would be depressing, if nothing else. But the question is whether this is true or not. And I hang out with scientists, obviously, since I am a science professor. And in science circles, this is kind of a going, working assumption that's sort of out there that people assume that you're supposed to believe if you're a true scientist. But I want to consider another perspective. That's the perspective of the idea of design. William Paley gave the famous watchmaker argument, but I'm going to do the cell phone argument. All right, so I'm going to borrow your cell phone. Can I borrow your cell phone? All right, thank you. So let's imagine you're walking down the street and you see that cell phone there and you're thinking, how did that get there? Well, I know. You know, there's some metal, some silicon, glass, blah, blah, blah. A car ran over it and people kicked around. Cell phone. Now, you're laughing. Because that's insane, right? But which is more complex? Which has more evidence of design? The simplest living thing or a cell phone? And I believe the simplest living thing has much more evidence of design. It is a nanofactory of almost infinite complexity. And yet there are some people who believe that it happened by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. I want to propose that that doesn't really make much sense. So what I'm going to do then, I'm going to talk a little bit about some chemistry, some biology, some physics, and basic stuff, stuff that I do just in an introductory course. Maybe a better illustration to the formation of life by random would be, let's imagine what you have is, let's say you've got a junkyard full of plastic and wood and all kinds of stuff. A tornado goes through there, out pops a 747. What do you think? All right. I think the evidence for design is overwhelming. So I'm going to start with chemistry. Now, hopefully, when you see H-O-H, you don't need the little label over there. Did you need that label there? All right, good. I'm just saying. Cool job. Now, I could teach an entire one semester course just to explain all the properties unique to this one molecule, water. But here's the thing. Every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. To me, this is evidence of design. For example, water is bent. It's bent at about a 105-degree angle. You say, all right, so what's the big deal? Well, it turns out if water was straight instead of bent, it would boil at around minus 150 degrees centigrade, which would not be so good for us. We'd be vaporized. Now, another property, in order for life to exist, there needs to be a liquid. A liquid is a solvent, essentially, is required for life. A solid can't be the basis for life, obviously. Neither can a gas. And this liquid would have to be liquid in a particular temperature range. Scientists would tell you between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Above 80 centigrade, molecules fall apart. Below about minus 20, there's not enough energy to support chemical reactions. And it just so happens that water's liquid across almost that entire range. But actually, it's good that it's solid across part of that range, which I'll explain in a bit. But it just so happens that this amazing molecule, which happens to be liquid at the right temperature, also dissolves a wider range of molecules than any other substance. In fact, in order for life to exist, this solvent would have to dissolve ionized compounds. Because without ions being dissolved, you can't have like a nervous system. And it turns out there's literally only one liquid in the entire universe that dissolves ions. Just so happens to be water. Now, luckily, water doesn't dissolve everything. Otherwise, we'd be a puddle. That would be a problem also. Okay, water has a few other properties. One, water absorbs more heat than any other substance by far. More than twice all substances, and more like 10 times as much heat as most substances. You think, oh, okay, so whatever. Well, if that weren't the case, then the temperature of the Earth would go up and down by a couple hundred degrees centigrade in any given year, in which case, again, there'd be no life. So the same compound that happens to be bent so it has the right boiling point, the right solvent properties, also happens to be the only molecule that can control the temperature of the Earth, otherwise there'd be no life. But that's not all. One property that water has, which is completely unique, is that the solid floats on the liquid. You say, all right, well, whatever. Well, guess there are millions and millions of molecules. Of all those millions of molecules, guess how many of them have the solid floating on the liquid? Only one, and it's water. And you see, what's the big deal about that? Well, in the winter, what happens is the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, lakes would freeze to the bottom. Okay. But during ice ages, oceans would have frozen to the bottom, and life on Earth would have ended. But water has another property. This is a really bizarre property. Every other substance in the universe, when they get warmer, their density goes down. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one, and it's water. Water has this really weird property. As you cool it off, it maximizes its density at 4 degrees, and then it drops so that the cooler water is actually less dense than the warmer water. So in the winter, the colder ice, the colder water, and then the warmer water below. All right, anyway, we can talk about the viscosity of water, the electrical conductivity of water, all these other things. I would say this is clear evidence of design. The idea that this just so happened, to me, is kind of bizarre, actually. All right, let's talk about this. Now, some of you are probably getting, hives right now, or really nervous. Not Cesar. No, Cesar, this is his bread and butter, right? There are at least 22 elements that I know of that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. Now, our friends like Dawkins and Huxley argue this is just an accident. I say, really? Do you actually believe that? All right, Cesar, which element am I going to start with? The one that's got the most properties unique to it, special to life. Carbon, see, he's been paying attention. Okay, great. Now, I teach organic chemistry, and when I teach organic chemistry, the first week, I spend the entire week talking about all the properties unique to carbon. No other element has them. And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have that property, in fact, all of those properties combined, there'd be no life. All right? Seems pretty convincing to me. And like, oh, I forgot to mention my little introduction. I told you I was an atheist. I forgot to tell you why I stopped being an atheist. It's because of studying science. And these kinds of things, I'm like, wait a minute. Oh, let me give you an example. Carbon forms four bonds. Actually, it's not the only element that forms bonds, four bonds, because silicon does as well. But the problem with silicon is if you put two silicon atoms together, that molecule explodes, which wouldn't exactly work for living things. Now, why is four bonds important? Well, as you know, unless you have four bonds, the molecules would not be three-dimensional. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, then you don't have three-dimensional living things. By the way, the only element that forms three-dimensional molecules is also the only element that forms large molecules. All right, and also single, double, and triple bonds, rings, all that other stuff that I'm not going to bore people with. All right, there's at least 22 elements that I know. One of them is iron. Let's talk about iron. Iron has a unique property, and it's the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. And all right, why is that important? Well, because otherwise, where would you put your children's homework on the refrigerator? How would you do that? All right, no, that's not the reason. It turns out, in order for life to exist on the Earth, it needs a source of energy. Now, that energy has to come from a place that's really, really hot. Now, it just so happens, that 90% of the energy coming from the sun is visible light. 90%. Lucky for us, because that's the only kind of light that can induce chemical reactions without destroying molecules. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all life on the Earth, except there's two different elements that God created to protect us from those. Anyway, one of those is this high-energy ionized particles called the solar wind. And it turns out the magnetic field of the Earth, because of the iron, literally is a force field to deflect those particles away. Some people say, we just got lucky. I say, that's pretty darn lucky. Now, but there's another coincidence here, because it just so happens when I teach nuclear chemistry that iron, from the point of view of its nucleus, iron is the most stable element in the universe. So guess what the Earth is made out of mostly? Iron. So the only element that's magnetic is also the most common element. Otherwise, having it be magnetic wouldn't do us any good. And there are people who think this is all just an accident. I say, wow, that's a pretty big set of accidents. You really believe that? Do you really believe that? We can talk about oxygen. Oxygen, what's cool about oxygen is it forms two different molecules, both of which are absolutely essential to life, at least to high-energy metabolism life, O2, the more famous one, which, by the way, life can exist without O2, but not high-metabolism life forms. The other kind, ozone, which is poisonous, but lucky for us, is only in the upper atmosphere. Go figure. And it absorbs ultraviolet light. Otherwise, life on the Earth would not exist. Now, I could talk about helium. I could talk about hydrogen. I could talk about several elements. Let's talk about uranium for a minute. All right, you might think that uranium is dangerous, right? It's because it is. Okay, it's radioactive. Lucky for us. Because if uranium was not radioactive, we wouldn't be here. And the reason is uranium has a half-life of around 4.5 billion years, which happens to be the age of the Earth. So when I teach them my science class, so I say, so how much of the uranium is still left?
Half.
There you go. And what it turns out it does is it produces heat inside the Earth, which causes plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is like a massive recycling system. So the minerals in the Earth are recycled, otherwise the Earth's surface would be sterile. Also, if it were not for this heat being reduced by uranium, otherwise the Earth would be cold all the way to the middle, then we wouldn't have an atmosphere. So if you want to live on a planet without much uranium, Great, go to Mars. No atmosphere, sterile surface. By the way, another property of uranium is really, really dense. So guess where most of the uranium is? In the center of the Earth. Again, lucky for us. All right, let's talk about DNA for a minute. Now, I admit, when I talk about DNA, it kind of gives me a little, you know, the hair standing up. It is such an amazing molecule. All right, so I assume everybody here knows at least a little bit about DNA, the C, the G, the A, and the T. So basically, these are the different nucleotides, and three of the nucleotides are a code that decides the amino acid that goes into making the protein. So let me ask you the most basic possible question. You don't need to be a scientist to think about this. Could molecules just randomly bumping into each other create a code? No, that is not a rational conclusion. But there's people who believe it. They're called atheists. They believe that. So anyway, these things contain a lot of information. The human genome, about 3 billion base pairs. Let's just imagine the simplest life that supposedly happened by accident. So not 4 billion base pairs, not 3 billion, maybe 100 million, like an E. coli. Let's cut it in half, 50 million. Let's cut it in half again, 25 million. Let's imagine 25 million of these forming in a way that contained information. The chances of this information coming together by sheer accident of molecules bumping into each other would be kind of like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read them. It would make sense in whatever language you choose. I mean, if you did that enough times, would it eventually happen? No, it would not ever happen. But there's people who believe that it did. Again, this is why I believe that there has to be a God. But here's the interesting thing. The only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. And the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. So I ask people like Huxley, who says a long series of singularly beneficial accidents, which came first, the DNA or the proteins? You know, the chicken and the egg. The chicken and the egg is a piece of cake compared to this one. Because what you have to believe is, in the same place that the DNA appeared spontaneously out of nothing, with all this millions of pieces of information, in the same place the proteins that would have made that DNA, but didn't, because it didn't exist yet, the same protein that would have made the DNA and the same DNA that would have made the same protein have to both simultaneously come together in one place, and then this thing starts being alive. And there's, like I said, there's people that believe this. I personally find it to be... let me put it this way. It takes a lot of faith to be an atheist. I mean, I just don't know how they maintain this level of faith. And I'm serious. I mean, it's the faith to be a Christian, that's challenging. But I say the faith to be an atheist is astounding. All right, okay, we'll talk about that a little bit. Nature creates order, but not information. That's a second law of thermodynamics argument. I'll skip that. Even Charles Darwin said, it is mere rubbish to think at this point of the origin of life. He called it rubbish. That was probably a wise statement. We should probably stick with that. And now let's talk about a little physics. We talked chemistry, talked a little bit of biochemistry. Let's talk a little bit of physics. Now, before the 1940s, physicists as a whole, as a body, were convinced that the universe was eternal. Now, why did they think the universe was eternal? Well, the reason they thought that, by the way, it wasn't because of the evidence, because there was no evidence it was eternal. Because what's the alternative? Either the universe is eternal, or it was created. Well, philosophically, a created universe is a problem for atheism. So they concluded, well, it's eternal. But then the redshift was discovered, and the fact that the universe is expanding. And then physicists came up with excuses to explain that. And then they discovered the microwave background radiation. so that by the 1960s, it's basically a smoking gun here. Here's what physicists now believe, which is what the Bible said all along, which is there was nothing. No matter, no energy, even space and time themselves did not exist. And then in a brilliant flash of light, the entire universe came into existence in an instant, out of nothing. And then in Hebrews 11:3 it says, by faith we know that things are seen were not made from things that are seen, but made from something unseen. Or Genesis 1:1, let there be light. All right, so thank you, physics, for catching up with the Bible on that one. But let's talk a little bit about the nature of this thing. Now, by the way, the way, because I teach philosophy of science, and I train my students, they have to think carefully. They can't just say whatever they want. So I say, so did the Big Bang happen? My students say, I don't know. But it says, all the evidence implies that it happened. That's the best you can ever say. Okay? But it turns out, as physicists began to analyze what this event must have looked like, they discovered some astounding facts about the universe. And so we talk about what's called the finely tuned universe. All these instruments have to be in tune with each other, and otherwise it sounds terrible. It's kind of like that with the universe. Now, would you agree that that's a small number? Thank you. Thank you for agreeing with me. He's my friend. He would agree with anything I said, all right? All right, great. That's actually 59 zeros and a one. Here's the fact. The fact is, at least the properties of the universe point towards this. Turns out, if the force of gravity had been bigger than it is by that fraction, then the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. But on the other hand, if the force of gravity had been weaker than it is by that same fraction, then galaxies and stars never would have formed. So a good question to an atheist is, why does the universe exist at all? Why does anything exist? Good luck on that one. But, all right, let's say, why does gravity exist? Help me out with that one. All right, let's just assume it does exist. What are the chances it would have the right value? Well, there you go. Now, let's imagine you had a friend who won the Super Lotto. What would be your response? Wow. That's pretty good. What if they won the Super Lotto again the next week? The probability, let's just assume you have just a random universe, which is what our atheist friends believe. The probability having the right value for the force of gravity would be like winning the Super Lotto 6 times in a row. And if that happened, you'd be in jail. Okay? So what are the probabilities that the atheists are right, that the universe is just random? Well, there's a good way to go. I wouldn't want to play that probability personally. But it turns out that's not all. Don't try to read that slide. It's up there to represent that this information exists. It turns out almost every single parameter that defines how the universe works is like this. There are 4 fundamental forces: nuclear strong, nuclear weak, electric, and gravity. All 4 of them are finely tuned. Some to plus or minus 50%, others to 1 part in a million. I'll just give one example. Let me see. The strong nuclear force. That's what holds the protons and neutrons together. If it was a couple percent bigger, there'd be no hydrogen, and therefore no stars and no life. If it was just a few percent smaller, there'd be only hydrogen. Again, problematic. And the thing is, the list of these constants, which have to be very precise, otherwise the whole thing doesn't work, it goes on and on and on. There's like, I don't know, 36 on the list at this point. So at some point, I'm sorry, but it just borders on irrational to not believe in God. So that's what I'm trying to say here. Science of God. And again, there's this idea out there that kind of runs around that obviously a scientist wouldn't believe in God. I mean, obviously, because we know all intelligent people have given up such things along with fairy tales and pixie dust. Really? You know, I don't find myself agreeing with that. Okay, Fred Hoyle, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry. And I didn't even talk about biology. I'm not a biologist. So I'll, all right, there's a bunch of other all this other stuff. I think you get the general idea, probably pretty much. All right, so, sorry about that. I guess I'm hitting this button too many times. Okay, great. Oop, wow, okay. One time. All right, good. Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And I do not want to be disrespectful, but I would say, you know who has the least possible excuse for not believing in God? It's got to be the scientist. In fact, if you read on in Romans, it says, they choose, they willfully decide not to believe. They willfully ignore the obvious facts. Right, now, I want to talk about, just briefly, part two of our talk, I want to talk about a little bit about science in the Bible. Now, a little warning here. As you read the Bible is not a science book, okay? The Bible is a God book. All right, the way Galileo put it is, he said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So the Bible is not a science book. So, for example, when it says the sun rises and the sun sets, that's not a scientific statement. By the way, the sun does not rise. The earth spins, actually. All right, so that was the problem that Galileo was having. But on the other hand, I believe every single time the Bible makes a definite statement that relates to science, the Bible is accurate. To me, that's not an accident. Because really, from the first half of my talk, what have we really shown so far? Well, number one, there is a creator, and that creator is very smart and very powerful. But the next question would be, well, which one, you know? Krishna, I don't know, which one? So I'm going to argue that if we look at the Bible, the evidence says that one. Let me share a story. I was in a van with a bunch of science professors, traveling between venues at a conference, and one of my friends said, ha, 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 Christianity, what a stupid religion. I can't believe anybody believes that thing. She said, did you know in the Bible it says that if you wear clothing with two or more materials, capital punishment? What a stupid religion. Now notice, she was assuming that everybody in that van would agree with her. Obviously, we all know, obviously, any intelligent person knows that nobody could believe in God. To that I say, oh really? Anyway, I said, you know what? The Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. And then I said, you know what? People say the Bible is full of all kinds of scientific errors. I said, I've read it through at least half a dozen times. I haven't found one. I don't know what they're talking about. And then I pulled out my Bible. And I had to say a quick prayer, because I had to find the verse in Leviticus. Could you find that one? The verse in Leviticus that talks about clothing with two or more material. I had my 1978 NIV. All right, and I knew it was on the right-hand side about halfway down. Quick prayer, found it, and I read it. By the way, it doesn't mention anything about capital punishment, but God had a reason. We could talk about that. Oops, did my computer let out there? Could somebody sort of pay attention here and... Somebody kind of, while I'm talking. Thank you. I think it has to do with this thing's, doesn't get powered very well, so I don't know. Let me know when you get it, when you get power to it. All right, so I'm going to talk about the next slide. See that next slide? It's a picture of the Papyrus Ebers. Just pretend, all right? I think I showed it once. You remember that little sort of scroll-looking thing? Oh, great, great. That's Papyrus Ebers. It is essentially a PDR of ancient Egypt, a physician's desk reference. Basically, it's a compendium of medical knowledge from Egypt from roughly 1500 BC. Now, that's relevant to the question because that is more or less close to the time that Moses lived. Now, it just so happens there are a number of things in the Old Testament that seem to be relevant to medicine. All right? And here's the point that I'm going to be making. See, if my friend in the van was right, and the Bible's written by ignorant people in an ignorant age who didn't know what they're talking about, then there would be things like what you find in Papyrus Ebers. Why is it not getting power there?
We're working on it right now.
All right. No, that's not the problem. Trust me, it's the computer. So that's going to slow it down. This is the computer. You got power to the computer. So maybe find a place to plug this in. Okay. This thing here, it's at a funny angle. All right. It was getting some power. But definitely you want...
Okay. All right.
Well, anyway, they're working on it. All right. So now we're going to have to pretend. This presentation, it kind of needs the PowerPoint. So up on the screen, there's a quote from Papyrus Ebers. And basically it says, prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the oil of a rattlesnake. And to prevent baldness, a mixture of six fats, the horse, the ibex, all these different things, in order to prevent the hair from turning gray. All right? How's it going? Yeah, I just need to plug it in somewhere else. Perfect. So now we've got to turn this on. Good. All right. Now, some of the other prescriptions found in Papyrus Ebers are things like lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat, human excrement, moisture from pig's ears. These are the kinds of prescriptions you find in Papyrus Ebers. All right? And now, by the way, probably the Egyptians had some usable knowledge about medicine by trial and error, but these are the kinds of medicines they had. All right, great. Good job, guys. Okay, very good. Yeah, this part's really hard to do without a PowerPoint. I don't know how to do it. Come on, wake up, computer. It's waking up. I'm a hot dog. Those kids love to hear. Okay, function, blah, 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 duplicate. There we go. Slideshow. Okay, slideshow. Beginning. Excellent. All right. To prevent hair from turning gray, anoint with the blood of a calf which has been boiled in oil over the fat of a rattlesnake. Mixture of six fats, horse, hippo, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex to prevent hair loss. Clearly, I've not been using that stuff. Okay, great. Some other ingredients in Papyrus Ebers. Now, we're sort of chuckling about this, but actually, this is tragic. The average lifespan back then was maybe 20 years old if you're lucky. Not that people couldn't live to be 80, it's just that almost everybody died of an infectious disease at a very young age. All right, now, if the Bible was what the skeptics and critics say it was, such as my friend in the van, then the Bible would have things like this. And I'm going to claim, and you can judge for yourself, if you find an exception, please send it to me. I haven't found it yet. I'm going to claim that the Bible is different. Now, there's a very interesting quote. It's in Exodus 15:26, where God says to his people, if you obey the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have any of the diseases of the neighboring people. And we're going to look at several examples which basically explain what's going on here. And so one example would be in Leviticus 11. In Leviticus 11, you're probably aware there are certain kinds of meat the Jews were told they could eat and certain kinds they could not eat. I assume you know that. Okay, well, it just so happens that every kind of meat God said it was okay for them to eat is relatively safe. And every kind of meat God said not to eat is full of different diseases. For example, beef, yes. Pork, no. Pork carries at least 22 known diseases. One of them is trichinosis. And by the way, with modern safety methods, pork is relatively safe, but even then, cook it all the way through, right? Beef, safe, even raw. In fact, I was in Venezuela a few years ago with Jan, and I ordered it off the menu. I can speak Spanish, but I didn't know what that stuff was. I said, just bring me that one. It was a plate of raw beef. I thought about Leviticus 11. I went for it. Now, according to the Bible, according to the Old Testament, fish with scales, okay. Every kind of shellfish, not okay. And it just so happens that every kind of shellfish contains many, many different kinds of diseases. And fish, even raw, is relatively safe. Now, if this was the only example in the Old Testament, I'd say the skeptic could maybe hold out if they wanted to. But I would say this, every other people ate all these things and died from them. The Jews did not. Think about this. What cultures have a continuous history for over 3,500 years? See, the Chinese, Egyptian, the Indian culture, and then the Jews. They don't seem to fit in that company very well. And I would argue one of the reasons the Jews have been so successful over the years is because when they obey God's laws, they live longer, live healthier life, had more children. Okay, another example is in Numbers 19, where it says, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean for 7 days, and then you have to clean yourself with the ash and the hyssop on the first and the seventh day. What's going on there? It seems kind of harsh. I mean, why would God do this? Because what this means is, if you help prepare the body for the funeral, you can't even take part in the funeral. So why would God have such a cruel law? Well, this is Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a doctor in a hospital in Vienna. This is back in the days when germ theory was being developed. He worked in a women's hospital. And in that hospital, 20% of the women who checked in the hospital died in the hospital. I'm telling you, that's a really bad rate. Women didn't give birth in hospitals back then, not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital, but because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. All right, anyway, Semmelweis. Oh, by the way, I was given this lesson in Budapest, and I said that he was from Yugoslavia, from Serbia. They said, no, he's from Hungary. He's from Budapest. And then they took me to his house. So I now say he's actually from Budapest. But anyway, so the death rate was close to 20%. And so what Semmelweis noticed is the doctors would come in the morning, they would examine the women that had passed away the night before from an infection, and then they'd go upstairs into the wards and treat the patients. We go, oh my goodness, that doesn't seem like a very good idea. So he said, whenever you touch a dead body, you wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went down to 4%. Now the Bible has another, the Old Testament, just, you know, as Christians, we're not under these laws. This is the Old Testament. It has another law that says when women give birth or when they're in their period, they're unclean. Now, why would God say that? Well, everybody knows it's because God hates women. No, that's not what it is. It's because he loves them. Because in those situations, women are very susceptible to infection. So some of us said, now between every live patient, you clean your hands carefully with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%. Okay? You would think they'd have a ticker tape parade or whatever they would do. No, they fired him. And a few months later, he died of an infection. Now, the prescription, if you read in Numbers 19, was to take ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, water, and hyssop. And you mix them, and that's what you use. Now, it just so happens, hyssop is kind of like the thyme, you know, the that herb. It's very, very oily. If you mix hyssop with ash and water, you make soap. But it just so happens hyssop is unusual in that the oil of hyssop contains 10% of this molecule. All right, you've had one semester of organic, right? What's the name of that? It's a phenol. It's a phenol. Remember that? It's a phenol, yeah. All right, now, when I teach organic chemistry, when I teach about phenols, I tell them the principal property you need to know about phenols is phenols are antiseptic. In other words, although they're not poisonous to humans, they kill bacteria. So God's prescription, if you touch a dead body, was to clean yourself and everything you touch with powerful antibacterial soap on the first and the seventh day. Ah, okay, that's starting to make some sense. All right, another one is leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. It didn't kill the most people. Cholera killed more people. Typhus killed more people. Malaria killed more people. But it's the way the leprosy kills. It's just, it's horrendous. Oh, they had many, the fear of all other diseases taken together can't be compared to leprosy. Now, the Bible had a simple prescription. As long as the person is alive and has this disease, they have to be completely separate from the people. Again, so harsh, so cruel. In the 16th century, in Scandinavia, some monks were reading the Old Testament, and they said, let's just try it. By the way, leprosy was rampant in Europe at that time. So they tried using this prescription, and within two generations, leprosy had virtually disappeared in all of Europe. Simply by following a prescription in the Bible. All right, here's another one. Leviticus 17:14 says, the life of every creature is in its blood. Do you know what the most common medical treatment was in the 18th and 19th century, at least in Europe and America? It was bloodletting. Because science said that if you have an infection, the disease is in the blood. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Who was right? The Bible, of course. Because if you have an infectious disease, there's a thing called an immune system. And where is the immune system? It's in the blood. So the worst thing to do is bloodletting. Very bad idea. All right, one more example, because we want to get to our question and answer here. This goes back, this is actually not even the law of Moses. This goes back to Genesis. And it says in Genesis 17:12, God says to Abraham, from all the generations to come, on the eighth day, circumcise all your male children. What's that about? Ouch, that hurts. Well, 2 points. Number one, why circumcision? And number two, why the eighth day? Well, one thing I learned from this, see, God didn't tell them. He didn't say the reason you need to use the hyssop is because it's a powerful antibacterial soap. He says, just do it. And one thing I learned from this is, you know what? If God says to do it, just do it, even if you don't understand it, because it's going to work for you. And what's interesting is every one of these laws, not only did they give good health, they also had a spiritual meaning. There's a spiritual meaning to the life is in the blood, is there not? There's a spiritual meaning to this idea of the infection of leprosy and uncleanness. So it works in several different levels, which for us who are Christians, we're not surprised about that. So why circumcision? And why on the eighth day? Now remember, almost everybody back then died from some sort of infectious disease. Usually either bacteria or yeast. And bacteria and yeast, where do they thrive? Wherever is warm and wet and dark. Well, where's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? All right? Think of how many lives were saved by circumcision. And by the way, it was mostly female lives that were saved. Okay, if you think about it. Did you know there have been several studies that shows that the passing of AIDS from male to female is reduced by over 60% simply if there has been male circumcision. So then in Africa, they've begun massive adult male circumcision programs. Now, whether you should circumcise your male child or not In my opinion, it's a debatable medical practice at this point, because hopefully, guys, you take a shower. Okay, got it? But how many lives were saved? But then why the eighth day? That's bizarre. Why not the first day? Or maybe the 12th day, because, you know, the number 12, Jews, and number 7. Why the third day? Why the eighth day? Again, I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. The Bible doesn't say why circumcision. Doesn't say why the eighth day. But I think I know. I've got a hint. Turns out, if you circumcise a brand new newborn, they're going to bleed out. Because it turns out vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. So the child in the womb has no vitamin K. By the way, vitamin K is not what produces the blood clot. What produces the blood clot is the protein prothrombin. But vitamin K is required to make prothrombin. So not a good idea to circumcise a child on the day it's born. What happens is the child is born. Where do they get the vitamin K? From the bacteria in their gut that they don't get until they eat from mommy. And then what happens is, then the baby starts to form prothrombin, and the prothrombin level goes up to unnaturally high levels, and then it drops back down to its equilibrium level. I'm going to show you a graph of prothrombin in the newborn's blood versus number of days after they're born. Here's the graph. Didn't make it up. So guess what the safest day is? Literally, from the day they're born to the day they die, the safest day to perform a male circumcision. By the way, statistically, the seventh day or the ninth day would be pretty much about equal. All right? So again, to summarize, I'm going to do some question and answer. I would say, you know, there's this idea out there, you know, with really smart people who know a lot of history and philosophy and science, they obviously wouldn't believe in God. I say, that's nonsense. That doesn't make any sense at all. That nature screams that there is a God. Well, which God? Well, I would say, based on the evidence we've seen alone here tonight, I'd say probably the God of the Bible. By the way, I want to talk about the evidence that the Bible is inspired. So let's say this is the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. Now, the scientific evidence is like that much. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction compared to all the other reasons to believe the Bible is inspired. But that's another lecture. Have to come back later and do that one. Okay, great. So any questions? These could be Bible-related questions related to science and any of those kind of things. We'll do question and answer for maybe half an hour or so, or until people run out of energy. Yeah. Yeah.
My question is, the Holy Ghost, God, and Jesus Christ, is Jesus just a messenger? Like, who is God?
Okay. Well, I'm going to read from John chapter 1, verse 1, if I can pull out my Bible real quickly here. I'm sure I brought my Bible. I usually bring one with me. All right, great. John 1, 1. Now, by the way, what I'm about to read is not proof of anything. It's simply a statement. All right? And then you can either accept it or not. That's up to you. But this is what the Bible says on the subject. By the way, what it says is hard to get. I'm going to read it. It says here, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Then down in verse 14 it says, "And the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. We've seen His glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth." Talking about Jesus. So here's what John says about Jesus. Okay, he says, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Now let's just break that one down a little bit, all right? So today I was with Jan, and I am Jan. You see? So what the Bible says about the Father and the Son and the Spirit is something that's not logical from a human perspective. So God exists as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, people try to explain that, but I don't think there is a logical explanation of this. To me, what it's about is relationship, that God is relational. His nature is relational. And a good question is, why do we exist at all? Because God had nothing better to do? What the Bible says is the reason we exist is because God wanted to love us. He wanted us to love Him and to love one another. So this Trinity idea, which I'm not going to defend as a logical idea, honestly, that there's one God who exists in three persons. I would say to somebody who grew up in Christianity, we go, oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that's not a big deal. But no, actually, explain that to a Muslim. It's going to be hard for them to really even accept that, because they would accuse us of being tritheists. But we're not. If there's anything the Old Testament and the New Testament are absolutely solid on, there is one God. And as you know from the Old Testament. But God exists in three persons, entities. It's hard to come up with a vocabulary for it. But that's what the Bible says. And since Jesus walked on water, raised Lazarus from the dead, fulfilled the prophecies, was himself raised from the dead, I'm going to go ahead and just believe it. Okay? Good question. Any other questions? Can relate directly to our talk. There were some pretty unresolved questions even in my talk about science. And yes? Okay, great.
I gotta defend us in my question, but you talk a lot about complexity.
Yeah.
Why would complexity indicate that there is a God?
Well, where else would that complexity come from?
Well, when you're talking about God, is a God complex? So you wouldn't even have to beg the question, where did God come from?
All right. Let me reframe your question and ask you if it's okay the way I reframed it. This is the classic question. If creation requires a God, then who created God? And that is an amazing question. And I'll be honest with you, I can't provide a completely satisfactory answer. But I would say this. Clearly, something exists. Now, the way God answered the question himself, for what it's worth, Moses asked him, As he was going to go, God told him to go to save his people from slavery and bondage in Egypt. He said, who should I say sent me? And he said, I am. And in John 8, 56 through 58, they asked Jesus a question, who are you talking about, Abraham and all this sort of stuff? He said, before Abraham was born, I am. So what God is declaring about himself is he is, by definition, the self-existent one. Now, I can totally get how an atheist would go, that is crazy. But, we have to ask, which worldview can explain reality as we know it? All right, you could talk about, say, a Hindu worldview, which says the universe is eternal. Okay, but it's not. Or you could look at it, say, an atheist worldview, which says morality is not real, which says that this universe is not designed, it's just random. And I find myself dismissing that idea. But then the Christian claim, I have to admit, from outside of Christianity, it's like, really? Are you serious? So if that's the way you feel about it, I get it. And so I guess I'm just telling you what the Bible says and what Christianity says, and you have to decide which worldview works. Yeah.
How it's possible for it just to come together. The same has to apply to God, right?
No, it doesn't.
Well, then you're
let me for example, I'll talk about...
Is it more probable that the world just came into existence as opposed to there being a God?
You're going to have to make your own choice on that one. But I would say this. There's this thing called the cosmological argument. And basically, the argument is this. It's just a logical argument. You cannot prove the existence of God. I'm not saying that you can. Okay, you got that? All right, but the cosmological argument goes like this. Everything that exists, everything that begins to exist, was caused. Okay? And things exist, so therefore, they were caused. And God, by definition, is the cause of those things. Now, that may not be a completely convincing argument to you. I get it. So you have to think about it. Anyway, like I said, I was an atheist. A funny story is, the very first time I gave a talk like this was in UCSD, like 30 years ago. And there was a guy who came there. I met him 27 years later. And he said, yeah, I went to that talk. I was an atheist. I'm a Christian now. Thank you very much. But, I mean, you decide. And I'd be happy to talk some more, okay? But to me, the facts I know about the universe leaves the most rational explanation is that God exists rather than he does not. Okay? Question here and then back there. Okay, go ahead.
So this one's kind of off topic.
Okay.
Okay, so like I'm kind of doing my own little research on like psychedelics and stuff like that.
On what?
Psychedelics and stuff.
All right.
Okay, and I have this firm belief that Moses, Jesus, and some other people were in a sense consuming or using.
So you think Jesus was doing psilocybin or LSD or something like that? Okay, so you're saying in Da Vinci's painting there were some mushrooms in there?
I'm asking, not saying.
All right,
I'm asking
it's okay. That's a very interesting proposal. Okay, now I would say this. Let me. I'm going to go to a scene. This is in John chapter 11. Okay, John chapter 11. Let me answer your question, okay? And when I'm done, I may even take a second question from you. Although I'll probably take hers first and then come back to you, if it's okay. John 11. Again, now, you're going to have to decide whether this is a true account or not. That's for you to decide, okay? I believe the evidence is the New Testament writers are being honest about what actually happened. So anyway, in the situation here, Lazarus, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were like best friends of Jesus. In fact, they were probably closer friends of Jesus even than some of his apostles. Lazarus was very sick. He was at the point of death. They sent to Jesus, who everybody knew had healed thousands of people, even raised people from the dead. All right? And he didn't come. He came on the fourth day. And there's a scene here in this whole thing going on. Where Jesus said to Martha, your brother will rise again. She said, I know he's going to rise in the resurrection. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. Whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? So Jesus is claiming that if we believe in him, we will live even though we die. All right, you say, therefore he's on mushrooms. Okay, possibly. All right, anyway, they go out to the grave and he asks them to pull back the gravestone. And they say, but Lord, he's been in there 4 days. There's a very bad smell. They pulled back the stone and he said, Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus came out after 4 days. He came out of that tomb. All right. And what's interesting, if you read that passage, it says, and therefore many who were there believed in him. But also interestingly, that's when they decided this is it. We're going to kill him. And those who decided to kill him, it wasn't because they didn't believe he did the miracle. Is because they did believe he did the miracle. Now, I don't think that's LSD. I don't think that's hallucinogenic drugs. And so, Jesus walking on water, you could say that maybe they were on drugs. I don't know. But Jesus wasn't on drugs. To me, I don't think that's a rational explanation of the things that are recorded in the Bible. Okay? Now, you've got a second question. I'm going to go up here, and I can come back. I don't mean to ignore you, okay? Question back here. You need to speak fairly loudly, okay? Okay. All right. Could be, okay. Good. Yes. I'm looking for questions, though. Any questions? Yes.
I have a few questions.
All right.
Just like he stated, I just wanted to say something. I'm a Christian, and I feel I have to defend this. You know, nothing against you. I don't want to be argumentative.
But do you have a question?
Yes, sir.
Not a comment, a question.
I walked in a little late.
Okay.
And I wasn't sure if, are you questioning if there was a Big Bang?
Okay. Now, the evidence supports the idea because of the fact that the universe is very, very rapidly expanding. Also, the distribution of the elements, that's a detail that I'm not going to go into here. But also the microwave radiation that fills the universe. It's all consistent with one model, which is this model of creation by a singularity, if you will. So the evidence points to an event around 13.5 billion years ago. That's what the evidence points to, of a creation event out of nothing. Now, that doesn't mean it happened. I mean, we weren't there. Nobody here was there. So in science, all you can do is look at the evidence. All right, you see the tree doing this. You go, oh, I think there's some wind here. We see the data. It's consistent with this creation event. I believe this creation event is consistent with the Christian worldview. All right? And the fact that the Bible even describes the creation as let there be light. That doesn't prove God, but I'm just saying it's consistent. Now, some people would say, well, what about, you know, the 7 days of creation? All right. Well, we could talk about that if somebody wants to ask that question. Yeah. Oh, somebody wants to ask that question. All right. All right, yeah.
If you believe it was 7 literal days, why not?
All right. Now, by the way, I believe God could do that if he wanted to. When I teach, I teach like a philosophy and history of science class in San Diego. Not now, but I did for about 18 years. And what I do is I would try, because I had students who believed in the young earth. By the way, I don't believe the earth is young. I just tell you right now. But I'd be willing to defend it. So the way I'd handle it in class, I'd say, all right, class, I want to talk about this idea that the earth is young. And as you know, some people believe that's what the Bible says. That's not what I think, but I want to defend that idea. So then I say, I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to pretend I'm a theologian. By the way, I sort of am, but I don't tell them that. All right, great. So I say, all right, let's just say as a proposition that there exists an all-knowing, all-powerful, omni-this, omni-that God. Now, could that God create the universe so that at the moment of its creation it appeared old? The answer is yes. I mean, okay, great. So then the question is, well, is that what actually happened? Now, if that were the case, science wouldn't have anything to say about that. And I kind of hop back over here. And I say, well, okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, I could see that as a possibility. I can't just dismiss it. But what about a galaxy that's a billion light years away? So we're looking through our telescope. The light from that galaxy a billion light years away is coming through our telescope. Well, then when did that light leave that galaxy? A billion years ago. So to me, that says that that galaxy's at least a billion years old. All right? But if God wanted to create the universe with an appearance of age, I guess he could create the galaxy and even the light kind of on the way here, okay? I find that explanation to be a little fishy, all right? But then again, Jesus made fish and it was ready to go already, so Jesus could do that, all right? So let's talk about Genesis 1. The general outline of Genesis 1 is this. There was nothing. And then God made everything. And he made the earth. And it was covered with water. And the land emerged from the water. And then life began, first in the water. And then after that happened, it changed the atmosphere of the earth to the point where you could even see the sun and the moon and the stars. Then life came up on the land and in the air. And eventually the most complex life form of all, us. So the general outline of Genesis 1 fits with everything I know from science. I personally believe those days are metaphorical in the sense. It's like it's sort of an account of just generally what God did. First he did this, then he did this, then he did this, then he did this. Now I'll admit the word used there is the word yom, which literally means day. But I believe that day is metaphorical. And by the way, Philo, the Greek philosopher of the first century, agreed with that. Origen, Tertullian, all the early, not all of them, but most of the early Christian theologians also agreed those days were metaphorical rather than literal. So that's my understanding of it. Well, I would say this. I would say to that person over there, you do agree the earth appears old, right? And that person would say, yes, I agree with that, because it does. Okay, yeah, question. Okay, is there scientific evidence proving the prophecies of Revelation? Science has to do with physical things. And prophecies and Revelation, that's not even the realm of science.
Well, I'm saying are there prophecies?
All right, now, so maybe you don't mean is there scientific evidence. You mean, because the evidence related to prophecy is outside the realm of science altogether. All right, so we could ask, for example, is there evidence that prophecy in the Bible, first of all, that it really is prophecy? In other words, it was given way before the event happened, and that it did indeed predict an event that did happen. All right, well, that I need a half an hour for that one. But we could go to, say, Psalm 22, 16 through 18, where David says, they've pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They divided my garments amongst them and cast lots for my clothing. That was written around 1000 B.C. We actually have the Psalms in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have proof positive it was written hundreds of years before Jesus was born. And it just so happens that Jesus was crucified. That's a historical fact. We know that because people like Josephus, a Jewish non-Christian historian, said so. Tacitus, a Roman non-Christian historian, said so. So I would say this is not a scientific kind of proof. It's just not. It's not even related to science. Or we could talk about the prophecy, say, in Zechariah 11, verse 16, where it says, basically, it has God saying, "The price at which they priced me, 30 pieces of silver." And I said, throw it to the potter. Well, it just so happens that Jesus was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. So I would say this is more like historical evidence than scientific evidence. We could talk about the prophecy in Isaiah 53 that the Messiah would be pierced. Or the prophecy in Micah 5, verse 1, that he would be born in Bethlehem. Or the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24 and 25, that the Messiah would come to Jerusalem roughly in 30 AD. So kind of if you take all this together, I think there's good evidence that prophecy is real, and it's evidence for some kind of inspiration. All right, but that's not a scientific kind of evidence. That's a whole different kind of evidence. There's many different kinds of evidence for the Bible to be inspired. I could talk about its consistency with history, the fact that it, even though there's at least 60 different authors, the message is essentially the same. Many kinds of evidence. All right, I'll take another question. All right, I haven't kept good. I'll come back to you. I'll take more than one from you. That's good. So I'm going to take first. All right, we'll take it from you first. There's somebody behind you also. You'll be next, okay?
Yeah.
An anthropology? Okay, good. All right, good. So how's the whole Adam and Eve thing work, given the evidence from anthropology? Now, first of all, at the risk of shocking some of you Christians, the idea that we physically evolve from a common ancestor to apes is not a ridiculous idea. Scientifically, the idea that we have a common ancestor with gorillas and chimpanzees is not a crazy idea. Okay? Just throw it out there. And I could talk about, well, I'll just give you one fact. All right. Now, all mammals produce vitamin C, except orangutans, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, I'm probably forgetting one, human beings, and guinea pigs. Now, we have the gene that makes vitamin C, but it doesn't work because there was some sort of a mutation. By the way, guinea pigs also have a mutation, but a different one. So that's sort of a random other thing. So you could say that's a coincidence, but you know what? Honestly, that doesn't seem like a coincidence to me. Now I'm going to tell you, where did we start? Right there. Okay, good. I believe in the story of Adam and Eve.
Let me tell you why I believe the story of Adam and Eve. Because it's in the Bible. Okay? And I'm not going to pretend differently. One thing that gets Christians in trouble is this. They don't separate the things they believe because of faith from the things they believe because of evidence. And that's a thinking error. Let me give an example of something I believe because of the evidence. I believe the universe was created because of the evidence. I believe life was created because of the evidence. I believe the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence, like the prophecy evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. I believe in heaven, and I have absolutely no evidence of that at all. I believe in Adam and Eve. I'm just tell you why. I'll just confess it to all of you right here, because the Bible says so. So how does that work exactly? We could talk about that. I've got a book, Is There a God? I go into that in a fair amount of detail. I don't mean to duck the question. Possibly there are other intelligent primates around. I don't know. Or maybe Adam and Eve are the first ones who were made in God's image. I really can't give you a totally, absolutely satisfactory answer, probably. I would say this, though. Evolution was invented by God, not by scientists. Evolution is real. And since God invented it, we Christians probably ought to just give him credit for it instead of trying to get defensive about it. That's my opinion. Okay, great. Now, behind you...
Same question.
What an amazing coincidence. Okay, great. It's a very smart section of the crowd back there. Okay, we're going to give you another shot. Let's go another about 10 minutes, okay? Good, go for it.
You walked in a little late. You said people back then only lived to be 20,
30 years. On average.
I could be incorrect, but I thought the Bible said that it was a lot lengthier life back
then. No, what I'm saying is... the evidence, as they study, as they dig up grave sites, the evidence is in ancient times, the average lifespan of a human being was around 20. Now, like I said at the time, people back then lived to be 80 or 90, but it was just so rare because almost everybody died from an infectious disease. So if you go to these ancient cemeteries, there's babies, infants, like it's mostly infants. Even in America, if you go to, let's say, a graveyard in, say, New Mexico in 1746 or something like that. It's mostly infants there because that's just what happened.
Does it say in the Bible that we live longer years, though?
All right. The Bible says that at least the descendants of Adam and Eve lived extended lifetimes for a certain limited period of time.
Was it like 500, 700?
It was in a few hundred years. Now... Again, that's one of those things I'm going to tell you. I believe it because it says so in the Bible. I have a possible explanation, which is Adam and Eve were created without some of the genetic mutations that we've had. But I can't prove that.
And there wasn't no diseases and stuff like that back then.
Well, I mean, there were diseases back then, you know.
The creation,
well, you know.
Couldn't the diseases come from somewhere?
Hmm?
I figured that.
No, okay. Bacteria are necessary to life. If you take a microbiology class, if it were not for bacteria, there'd be no nitrogen in the ground, there'd be no oxygen in the air. I mean, we are completely, utterly dependent on bacteria. Now, it just so happens, some kinds of bacteria are dangerous to life. You say, well, why did God allow that to happen? Well, God's not in the job of keeping us alive for an infinite amount of time. The fact that we die from a theological perspective is really not problematic. From a theological perspective, the problem is sin and separation from God. All right. But the fact is that it doesn't take a lot of knowledge to notice that people don't live forever. And the Bible explains that that was part of God's plan, that these bodies were never intended to be eternal, that God has an eternity waiting. All right. Got it? Okay, I'm going to take this question and then that one. Go ahead.
I heard the explanation that after the flood, because they started eating meat, that was a possibility of why their lifespan decreased.
All right.
All right, that's a possibility.
You see that you put
both in place. Okay. It's a possibility. Good. Question back here. Yeah, yeah.
So would that blend a little bit of morality into your class?
Okay, I taught a class called Intro to Scientific Thought for many, many years at Grossmont College, and we did a section on ethics. And so what I would do is when I introduce that topic, I would say, by the way, just, you know, most people don't realize the distinction between ethics and morality. So ethics has to do with sort of cost-benefit analysis. Something is unethical if it harms people. All right? And I say, by the way, just so you know, atheists are as ethical as non-atheists. In fact, my experience, if I can be honest with you, is that atheists seem to go out of their way to be ethical, the ones that I know. So they may even be a cut above, possibly. I don't know. But morality is something completely different. Morality has to do with what's right and wrong. And morality comes from an authoritative source of such knowledge. So technically, an atheist cannot be moral, technically, because morality is an idea that they reject, simply because morality it means some sort of supernatural source of truth, if you will. So in that class, I say, we're only going to discuss ethics. Actually, then they do group presentations and say, if you want to bring up moral issues, go ahead, but be cautious, okay? Because from our perspective in a secular university, that would be a matter of, say, opinion in a secular university. Whereas ethics, I don't really think ethics really is a matter of opinion. It's unethical to destroy the environment. It's unethical to lie. You know, there are certain things that are unethical. And so whether Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, atheist, we all can kind of agree on those things, I would say. Okay? That's ethics. Morality is something different. Now, I would say this. Most world religions will have a fairly similar moral standard, which is an interesting fact. All right? We have to deal with that as well. Okay? Good. By the way, I'm letting you be my barometer. I'm watching whether you're kind of going, or like that. I'm going, all right, good. Whether I'm doing a good job or not. So thank you for being my barometer there. I appreciate that. Good.
Assuming I know very little about physics, is the ratio from matter to antimatter in the creation or expanding or whatever universe thing significant in
way your argument? Yes. Although I can't remember if it was on the list there. But the balance between matter and antimatter, it's almost exactly equal amounts. And that tiny, tiny excess of matter is what the universe is actually made up out of. Now, that's the way I understand it. I'm not a high-energy particle physics guy. I'm a chemist who studies a lot of physics and got a doctorate in physics, but I'm faking it occasionally in high-energy physics. But that's the way I understand it. All right, it's kind of similar to protons and electrons, because according to the Big Bang model, electrons were made through one process, and protons were made to a totally different process, and yet they're balanced to one part in 10 to the 30th or something like that. If that were not true, the universe would be governed by electrical forces instead of by gravity forces, and again, the whole universe wouldn't work. So that's another one of those crazy coincidences that I believe argues for design. Okay, so yes, again, stuff that, you know, probably might go over the head of a couple people in this room. It's apparent that the amount of matter and antimatter is almost perfectly balanced, but not perfectly balanced, which again is a requirement in order to have a universe. By the way, a lot of people who want to keep the idea of atheism say, well, that's because there's an infinite number of universes. It's called the multiverse theory. Now, the multiverse theory is what I call an ad hoc theory. It's a theory created not because of evidence, but because of a problem with the evidence. So you create an ad hoc theory when the evidence is pointing in a direction opposite of what you believe, essentially. So you create an ad hoc theory that means to that. So the theory is created not out of the evidence, but as a way to essentially get around the evidence. By the way, we humans do ad hoc theories all the time. For example, let's say I heard that my wife had lunch with some guy. I'd come up with an ad hoc theory on that one because I know she's faithful to me. So just because I'm accusing atheists of having an ad hoc theory doesn't mean they're crazy or wrong. But I'm saying this multiverse theory is not based on any evidence. I believe it was created to solve a problem, which is the problem that I raised tonight. And yours is just one more example. Okay? Okay, I'll take one more.
Where are your classes at? Your teaching
them? Are they here on campus? Oh, okay. So I've been a chemistry and physics professor for 35 years. All right, and I hit 63, almost 64, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to do something else. So I decided instead, I'm an author. I've got many books here. You can pick some copies. And I've taught on biblical topics in 80 countries and all over the world and all that kind of stuff. And then some crazy group here in Bakersfield asked me if I'd be their minister. And crazier than that is I said yes. So I came here. So I had a bit of a career change. But I'm hoping to teach at least one class here at BC, just to kind of keep my finger in there. All right? Thank you for coming tonight. Chris is going to come up and give you an invitation. Thank you very much.
Way out. He'll be more than glad to take those surveys back from you at the end.